Do you want to be a more successful leader of your company or any organization? I'm Rick Williams. Welcome to the Create the Future podcast. I have guests come on my podcast to share their stories about making difficult decisions that determine the future of their company. We learn what worked, what didn't work, and we have a little fun along the way. You will be a more successful leader if you listen to and learn from these stories. So I have a great guest today, and I'm excited to get started. Larry Galko is a brand architect and strategist. He runs leadership retreats called Brand New Day, where leadership teams do deep dives into what their customer is buying and what the company is selling. The goal is to help companies position their brands in a rapidly changing business and customer preference environment. Larry hosts and moderates marketing and branding events for Babson College, Harvard Business School, and Florida Atlantic University. He is the co-host of Brand Names podcast on CBS Boston. Now, Larry is a longtime friend and collaborator of mine and a truly unique thinker about the role of branding your product in the success of your company. Larry splits his time between the Boston area and Florida. So, Larry, get us started with a little bit about your journey getting to this point in your career. And I obviously have to welcome you to the Create the Future podcast, but get us started with telling us who you are and how you got to this point.
Yeah, you know, Rick, my career really has been really fascinating. You know, you grow up, your parents always think you should have a linear career, like their relatives were loyal to a company for 30 years, 40 years, whatever. And my career, like many of us as entrepreneurs and visionaries, it's been zigzagging, but the zigzagging's all worked out fine. But I don't know if you know this, Rick, but in high school, I went to a four-year all-boys high school in Boston to become an engineer. I went to the University of Miami in Florida, early decision for industrial engineering. After 2 months of being in the program, I dropped three courses. I couldn't stand engineering anymore. I couldn't stand chemistry. I asked my roommate, Alberto Gual from Puerto Rico, Alberto, what's your major? He says, Larry, in his dialect for Puerto Rico, he says, Larry, my major is marketing. I said, what's marketing? I said to him, like it was yesterday, Rick, I go to the market for my father. I get him his cigarettes and his newspaper and his milk. What's marketing? He says, Larry, come to a class tomorrow morning, consumer behavior, and you're going to learn about why people buy what they buy. And being, again, 4 years engineering, he could have been a psychology major. He could have been a food science major. I didn't know anything else because I was so tunnel vision with engineering. I went to this class, consumer behavior, and 40 years later, I've been in marketing branding all my life. But so the moral of the story is, if Alberto was in pre-law, I'd probably be a lawyer today. But I followed it, and I love what I do for a living. You know, the old saying, if you love what you do for a living, you'll never work a day in your life. And, you know, for 40 years, I've been helping companies build their brands. I've been very fortunate to have a program, naturally, with the Harvard Business School for 15 years, creating and hosting the CEO Brand Leadership Forum. Again, very privileged to have a TV show in Boston on NBC. And up until the pandemic, we had a podcast at CBS Boston. So again, I'm a growth advisor. My lane is focusing on the brand. And it's a great career. And I love what I do. And, you know, I think it's Bert Jacobs from Life is Good says, love what you do, do what you love. And that's what I've been doing for the last 40 years.
Well, Larry, before we get into talking about decision-making, what in the heck do you mean by brand anyway? I mean, I'm just buying a widget, aren't I? I mean, what does marketing branding have to do with buying a widget?
Well, you know, Rick, my thought process is the following. You have to create a brand voice that really, you have to create something special that resonates with the consumer. So that consumer feels, they perceive there's no brand like yours in the space that you live in. You know, like a while ago, I was doing some work with Harley Davidson, and I said to them, what are you really selling? And they said, no, we sell motorcycles. And I said, no, you're not selling motorcycles. At the end of the day, you're selling freedom. You're in the freedom business. Like Boston Children's Hospital, they're selling hope. You know, 15 years, number one pediatric hospital in the world. They're not selling Harvard Medical School. They're not selling, you know, innovation and breakthroughs, whatever. They're selling hope. So God forbid, if you have a child who needs medical care, you're coming to Boston Children's Hospital for hope that they're going to take care of your kid and he's going to go home healthy. And so the whole thing about brand is creating, and I tell people all the time, don't try to be the best, be the only. What can you be the only at? And the most important thing in marketing and branding is either dominating or owning a product category. Because if you don't own something, if you don't dominate something, if you're not first in mind, you have a brand name, but you're not a name brand. And so all you are is you're a commodity, you're stuck in the sea of sameness, and you're really like stuck in the muck. And so I tell this, I share a perspective from Ralph Waldo Emerson, which has guided me really, his mantra of like 30 something years, do not go where the path may lead, go instead where there's no path and leave a trail. So in branding, you can either be a following brand and be bottom price alone, or when people go left, you want to go right. So I always tell people, what are you doing to break through the marketing clutter to do three things, Rick, to drive brand leadership, ignite customer loyalty, and supercharge growth. And if you don't do those three, then you have a brand name, not a name brand, that's kind of floundering. It's funny, the other day I met somebody, I gave a speech at the PGA show in Orlando, and someone in the audience said, Larry, we're doing just fine. We're coasting along. And I said to them, very nicely, I said, when you coast, I've never seen anybody coast like this. I've seen people coast like this. So,
Right.
the other old saying is, if you're batting 1,000, like in baseball and branding and marketing, and you feel you're doing well, you're losing because you're too complacent. Somebody's going to steal your lunch any day, but you just can't stay status quo. And even today's world, as you know, and I know, with social media and marketing and the whole population exploding and the whole landscape is changing, you can't afford to stay still.
Well, that's great. I've witnessed you in action and dealing with the most senior business leaders, in action meaning leading the conversations with CEO of Delta and Harley-Davidson and all of these major corporations, talking with them about their brand and what they're trying to accomplish in the brand loyalty for their companies. And maybe as we get into this, you can talk a little bit about some examples from your work with all of these leaders.
Sure.
So but this podcast is supposed to be about helping folks listening to the podcast be better decision makers for themselves, for their company, and in some cases for themselves. So talk about some dis a one or more tough decisions you had to make and what that experience was like for you. How did you go about and do that?
Something, a real turning point in my career. Decades ago, I was an EVP for business development for an ad agency in Boston. And at those days, in that era, even in New England Adweek, you had to put down the name of your agency and the minimum billing of a client you would take on. And this agency, the minimum was $250,000. So if you had a project, $50,000, even if you were like a part of Gillette, they didn't care. They wanted a client that is so much minimum billing, that's it. So what happened was, personally, I was in charge of the new business development. And that time, there's a company called Burns of Boston, the frame company. They were owned by Hallmark. They had an $80,000 project. And my agency said, too small, get something bigger. Then I got a project from Gillette. They didn't want it. Too small, get something bigger. And then at that time, Favor Shoes, which was around then, owned by Moore Shoe Company, same thing. And so, it's a true story. About 4 days before New Year's Eve that year, I said to them, I said, this isn't working out. I'm entrepreneurial. I have a vision. What I mean, Jack Connors, and I mean, I didn't work for Hill Holliday. Jack Connors, who founded Hill Holliday, always told me, Larry, get a project you want from a client you really want, perform with excellence, and greatness will happen. And Hill Holliday started out with a $100,000 project those days with Wang. And before Wang imploded, they were billing them $40 million a year. So I share with the viewers here, get a project, get an assignment, get a scope of work that you really want from a desired client. Like Jack said, perform with excellence and greatness will happen. But forget about the entry number. So going back, I decided to resign and said, it's not working out. I have a vision that my vision and your vision is leadership. It didn't sink. And a week later, as I come home, I said to my wife, she asked me, how's things? That's good. I said, we have a 2-year-old child. We just got a brand new car and I'm out of a job. Happy New Year. Right? But what I did
Right.
was I went back to those three companies, and I knew some creative people in Boston. One's name was Larry, another name was Jimmy. Said, "Hey, I have these three clients. They're projects, 70,000, 50,000. Do you want as freelancers work with me?" "Sure, let's do it." And the first project we did for Gillette, okay, at the end of the day, I remember I met them in some deli in Brookline Village and with cash. And I said, "Here's $3,000 for you, here's $3,000 for you, here's $3,000 for me." Well, what happened was by me having the vision and the guts to lead that position, because I mean, and I said, really, Burns of Boston, if we can get into the world of Hallmark, who knows what can happen? But the agency was very short-sighted and said, "No, we don't want that." So that was the beginning of Galco and Company, which was an advertising and brand consultancy, which was a business very healthy for 20 years. And then 20 years later, I decided I didn't want to manage a business anymore. I just want to be me again. And so I went back to just being single shingle Larry Galco. But that was a hard decision to make. Your family and they're paying you well, but their philosophy and their culture really didn't mesh with what I wanted to do. And it was really Jack Connors who was always saying in my head, get something from a client you want, no matter what the initial price is, do great work. And believe me, Larry, you'll be there for a long time. And he was spot on. So I followed his guidance. So I owe Jack a lot of accolades and thank you. And sadly, he passed away a year ago. But man, I mean, that conversation I had with him stuck in all my life. Even now, I do projects for clients for $10,000, whatever, and all of a sudden they become $5,000 clients. Like the same philosophy has been embedded in me for years. And the people listening today, I tell them the same thing. I don't care what you're selling. Get into a client if you're selling retail and it's a small project or small order from TJ Maxx or Nordstrom's, whatever it might be, or anybody. If you really believe in that client or that organization, go for it. And you deliver on your brand promise, and you'll see that the good things will happen.
So, Larry, as I'm hearing you had two decisions you made. One was the decision to leave, to resign, and the second one was a decision to start a new company. I can imagine you're being scared to death about either one of those, but let's just separate them for a second, even though they may not be that separated in your mind at this point. But the decision to resign from the company you're working for, I mean, how did you come to the point of saying, I'm going to do that? Was it they wanted you to do a specific thing and you said, I really can't do this, I'm leaving? Or was this something that kind of built up to a point of making it? Talk about how you came to that decision.
It really was, it built up, Rick. It was, I was going out there, and actually, anybody in Boston would love to get a project, anything from Gillette, or at that time, Polaroid, or Echo Shoes, or whatever. And I felt that these are name brands, these are global iconic brands. And if we can get in the door, the old saying, if you're not walking the halls, they're not thinking about you. I just want to get in the door. But the ownership of the agency said, no, Larry, it's too small of an entry point. We're going to pass on that. And after three or four, I said, why am I passing on it? I can do that work for them. Said, but I love the people I met and said, hey, I'm going to do this. But it was scary. It was very scary leaving a job versus leaving a job. Usually people leave a job having something else and already set up. I left with a hope and a wish, but having an entrepreneurial spirit and having drive and like you, being relentless, I felt, I always tell people, passion plus commitment equals success. I had passion, I had a hell of a lot of commitment, and I was going to succeed. And I always told myself, if it didn't work out by quitting, it's not a life sentence, and I can always get a job in corporate America. They're a dime a dozen. But the timing was right. I had three companies who I had rapport. It wasn't the agency. They liked me. I liked them. So I said, shoot, I can take them on as my own client. I'm going to try it. So I was committed to it. And fortunately, at the end of the day, we had 15 employees. My average employee stayed with us 12 years, which is a long time. Every employee that we had who left did not go to another agency. One went to Pepperidge Farm. One went to be a social worker. They changed careers. And our average client stayed with us for 8.5 years. In advertising, the average is 3 years then. So we kept, like I say, we delivered on our brand promise. We told them what we're going to do for them, and we did it. and we're committed to them, and we treated them, and everybody here listening should treat your customers like they're your best friends. Because people have choices. And if you, and the only time you're going to lose a client, I believe, is when you screw up, when the brand screws up. Other than that, people love you. They adore you. They're endearing, and they're loyal. And also, people always talk about brand loyalty. I have another word that I've been using the last 5 years, Rick. It's not loyalty. I call it brand affection. I think it's much more powerful. So, for example, if you have brand affection, Rick, and you like and you love a certain car, and next year it goes up $5,000 more, you can always justify why you're going to pay the money. So I always tell people as well, become a want, not a need. Like, no one needs a BMW. If you want it, you'll find the money. No one, these people listening to our podcast today, no one needs you, Rick. No one needs me. No one needs any of the people listening to, okay? But if they want it, price should never be the object. Price should be long forgotten because you're driving success. You've relationship with these people. You're driving on your brand promise. You're delivering, okay? And at the end of the day, people never think about the price. They just think about the success you're driving with them. So price is really something that I always stay away from. But it saddens me sometimes with people in the professional service businesses, and I'm not a consultant. I don't like the word consultant. I'm an advisor. I'm a coach. Too many people said to me, oh, you're a consultant years ago? Oh, you're like the rest. Over-promise, under-deliver, expensive. But no. That isn't me. And so the word consultant, I work in a consultative mode, but I'm not a consultant. And I really feel that professional service people, a lot of them I talk to, like I'm sure, Rick, you're a friend, same thing. I don't know why people are afraid to charge a premium fee for a premium service of value. Not rip them off, but something premium. Many times, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to charge them, so much an hour or so much project. I just want to get them. But a good client will want to, doesn't need to, will want to pay your fee as long as you deliver what you promise on. If you don't deliver, then you rip them off. Then again, we all want to decrease expenses and increase investments. When you fall down on delivering your brand promise, you're an expense, and they want to cut you. And I wouldn't blame them. If I was a client, I'd do the same thing. I would cut it. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. You and I both know so many stories of people who think about, I'm going to say advertising, but yeah. I'm really just talking about marketing in general, a sort of an extra. And if you get into hard times, that's one of the first things to be cut. When it's in fact, it's probably the time you really should be putting money into maintaining your brand and visibility and value proposition in front of your customers.
You know, I remember years ago, we're going back, right? But you just rang a bell in my mind. There was a company I was working with in Cambridge, and they wanted to cut the marketing budget by 50%. And one day I went to their office for a meeting, and I said, what are all these boxes here? Oh, we just spent $45,000 on t-shirts and swag for our upcoming trade show. They didn't mind spending $50,000 on t-shirts and hats and money clips and everything else, but branding and advertising and marketing to drive revenue and growth. Oh, let's cut that like in half. But I couldn't believe all the crap they were buying for a trade show, which is not going to stimulate sales. Hey, free t-shirt, thank you. Hey, free mug, thank you, have a good day. I mean, it was like, what's going on here?
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, Larry, go back to, let's go back to making the decision to leave your old company. So did you talk to the people at the company about this? I know you brought your wife up, that you went home and told her on New Year's Eve and all this sort of, how did you go about actually making that decision? Did you involve other people in it or talk about to help you think it through, or how did you do that?
No, I know people have mentors and advisors, and I just knew I didn't want to do a coulda, woulda, shoulda. I knew it was right. I didn't want to just try to get new clients that had a $250,000 budget. And I felt these are young companies or sub brands for major companies that there was growth potential. And I did it. And without a doubt, I came home and my wife said to me, are you crazy? You know, it's New Year's in 4 days, whatever. You have no job. And she said to me, did you ever think about insurance, dental plans? Like, what are you talking about? And I said, I have to go for it. I said, just have faith in me and I have to do it. And I did whatever I did. And I remember I started in the basement of my house. I'm going to date myself now. There's no cell phones then, with a answering machine and a little recorder call button. I go into a phone booth, like on Boston Street, beep, you have 4 messages. And that's how we did it. There was no internet, right? There was no cell phones. I had a desk, and but I did have a saying, strive and you shall succeed. That was a saying I had on the wall of my little office, in my den, in my basement, my home. But, and basically I did cold calling. Again, there was no internet. I drove around office parks. I remember, I'll give an example. Johnson & Johnson orthopedic became a client of mine. I was one day in Taunton seeing my dentist, and I drove through Raynham. I saw an office park, and I just drove around. Huh. Jay is in Raynham, Mass. I'm gonna call them up. And they became a client for 5 years. But again, you can be a great marketer and a great entrepreneur and a great CMO, but you have to have that guts to do that cold calling, because no one's going to do it except you. And you have to cold call and cold call and cold call. And I think, Rick, all our lives, even today, I wouldn't say cold calling, but we're always selling ourselves. Or more importantly, no, let me smooth that out. We're always trying to influence someone's decision to either hire us or go to certain restaurants on the weekend, whatever. We're always influencing, but it takes a certain person. You might be a great CMO, but you might be an awful, entrepreneur. Like another comparison, you might be a great salesperson, number one in your company, but doesn't mean you're gonna be a great sales manager. It was
So,
hard. It was hard, but fortunately, but I think there was. I was relentless. I was committed. I'm saying, I don't care if it took 6 months, if I take a home equity line, it doesn't matter. I want to do this. I have three potential clients from great brands, and I really believe that I can do it. And there was no stopping me. And even my wife said, am I crazy? I said, no, I'm not crazy. I have to do this. And so I did it. And it worked out well.
It's interesting you were talking about your wife, as her input was telling you you're crazy. And I had a conversation, really terrific conversation with one of the earlier podcasts
Yeah.
with a guy who had a really successful career in the Marine Corps and retired in San Diego. And then had to decide about his next step. And I asked him a question I'm going to ask you in a minute about where he got the courage to say, I've now stepped out of the career in the Marine Corps. I'm going to start a recruiting agency. And where did he get the courage to do that? He said he got it from his wife, which is really a fascinating thing to say for somebody you would who's got the career of courageous men and women facing really difficult challenges. And where did his courage come? It actually came from his wife. And I mean, I know your wife a little bit, so I'm kind of privy to kind of what you're really saying when you say, well, my wife just told me I was crazy in doing this. But nonetheless, talk a little bit about if you are, you talked about cold calling. This is you're doing a step out in January to start a little agency on your own from your basement. You have to go out and do cold calling. Where did you get the nerve to do that?
I'll tell you something. I was interviewed by the member of the media about 4 years ago, and they asked me a question, Rick, similar to what you just said. And I told them, you want to know the truth? Here's the truth. I really mean this, because my father was a mechanic. My mother worked at an insurance company. My father's one of five siblings. None of them was in business. None of them. When I was 14 years old, every kid in Boston would love this job. I got a job at Fenway Park selling Coca-Cola at 14. Day games till 6 o'clock at night, and they call us hustlers. So all of a sudden, at 12 o'clock, all of a sudden, this guy Rico, we all be sitting with our white, uniforms on, Fenway Park. All right, Galgo Coke, or Galgo Pizza, or Galgo Souvenirs, and we had a hustle. We worked on commission, and at 14 years old, I learned, boy, the more Cokes I sell, the more money I'm making. It was hard. You're running up and down the bleachers. It's hot as hell. It's 9 degrees. The Coca-Cola at that time, it wasn't cans or whatever. It was cups, and they had plastic seals. And the white pants I gave you got all dirty with caramel colors from the Coke dripping. I worked from 14 years old to college at Fenway Park selling Coca-Cola and hot dogs and everything else. But the biggest thing was when the boss when the when it was Boston Patriots, and I know we're dating ourselves, but we're not old fogies. We're very young at heart, you and me, and I'm sure already other people listening, okay? The Patriots Sullivan Stadium was being built. The Red Sox played at Fenway Park for a season, and I was low man totem pole, and I had to go out in December with people, Afghans on their legs freezing. There were five of us out of maybe 300 hustlers. I had to yell, "Ice cold Coke here, ice cold Coke here, get ice cold Coke, get us hot chocolate, get out of here." So I really believe that the drive I got to hustle, to open up doors, happened by stance when I was 14 years old, selling for 5 years, hustling, running up and down those stairs, Girl Scout days, Boy Scout days, Nuns days, State of Maine day, whatever it was. I was always running up and down, selling product. And I just got, it was contagious. Boy, I made 13 bucks today. Boy, I made 15 bucks today. When the average minimum wage, I think it was $1.45 an hour. And I think that really was impetus to me being, sales oriented and driven, because I got at such a young age. I mentioned nobody in my family had any business entrepreneurial experience at all. They were all like laborers mostly. Yeah, so
Well, that,
it wasn't my wife. No way. Ah, no way.
well, you say that in retrospect, almost in a casual way, that of course I can go out and sell ice cold Coke at for the Patriots in November, but other people would be terrified to do that. They
Right.
can't bring themselves to the idea that they might be rejected by. Customers say, "I get out of here. I don't want any of that ice cold Coke in November." I mean, have you thought at all about kind of what it is that lets you do that?
I don't know. It was like, first of all, any kid 14 years old, if you get a job with the Red Sox, and again, there's no cell phones then. Before the game, the players would come out to a phone booth underneath first base there on my home plate. They'd be calling their wives and girlfriends. I'd be there talking to Kyle Yastrzemski, talking to, Bill Marquette, Ken Harrelson. A kid 14 years old, I'm talking to the Red Sox underneath the stands. But I don't know what it was, but it was just let me go for it. And as a kid living in Boston, to get there, I would walk to Mattapan Square near Milton, take a trolley to Ashmont Station. Ashmont, I would change over to Washington, walk into the Park Street, Park Street to Kenmore Square in a trolley, and get there. There was no cell phones. Hey, is Larry coming home tonight? Hey, is Larry safe? I came over tonight, but really today, think of today. What parent would allow their child to make five stops on the MBTA system to go get a
Right.
job in Kenmore Square? It
Right.
would not it would not happen. It wouldn't happen. So I don't know. I just think that, we all have our DNA, we all have our vision or drive, and I think when you have an opportunity, you say, what's the worst that can happen? So I quit. But I'll tell you something, and my son isn't listening. He's a very successful publicist in Nashville right now. I got him a job at Fenway Park, him and his friend. And his friend is an executive of Bloomberg today. And what you said, they joined the union. This is when they're high school. After one game, they both quit. They hate it. They couldn't take it. So you said to me, like, how do you persevere, whatever? And maybe it's hard to, hey, you want a Coke, whatever? One night game, and they both quit. They came home losing money because they joined the union and they never went back ever again. I said, what are you talking about? I got you this job. I spoon-fed it to you. Why don't you want it? And he says, Dad, we felt like slaves. Slaves? But I love my son. He's very successful, very entrepreneurial, but running up and down Fenway Park on those steps, tripping, having Coke dripping your pants. No way. They both quit. And they're both
Oh my
successful
God.
today in the corporate world. They're both very successful. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, let me ask you about a in your experience with your company,
Yeah.
whether you've had to fire a client or not. And the reason I'm asking this is I don't know if you remember meeting Paige Arnold Fenn, who
Yes.
okay, well, Paige has done one of my podcast,
She's great. She's
and
great.
she is really terrific.
She
And
is.
she told the story of having to of her decision to fire one of her first and most important clients,
Right.
and what, how she went about bringing herself to doing that and feeling that it was really the right thing for her and for company. Have you had an experience with firing one of your clients? And if so, what was that like?
Yes, it was very hard. When you work so hard to get a client, the last thing you want to do is fire somebody or hear someone say no. It's like it's very hard. And I'll tell you, the client, it's very interesting. Pantone, the company that created the whole coloring system, PMS colors that everyone uses all over the world, they're the standard. They started out making colors initially for women's makeup. And then they progressed into the advertising, collateral marketing, printing world, whatever. But PMS is a standard. And let's face it, from Boston, Massachusetts to Monarchy, New Jersey, there's a lot of designers, a lot of ad agencies they could have hired to launch a new metallic brand for them. And they hired us, which blew my mind. Pantone hired us, right? Well, after 4 months, we fired them. Oh, no, we resigned them. First client ever resigned. Never resigned a client in 20 years. Never. People resigned us here and there, but never resigned them because the Herberts, the own company, the father was involved, the mother was involved, the two daughters, kids was involved, the grandfather was involved. I would have meetings with nine people, and the grandfather would say, "Here's the headline we should have," and I'm saying, "What's going on here?" The whole family was involved in every decision, and I kept saying to them, "No, you're hiring us for our expertise and our guidance. I have no problem. I have no problem modifying copy, headline, subhead, visual. I have no problem at all." But they were giving us directives to the point it was so bad. I remember one campaign, we redid it 7 times because I didn't want to say no to them. I mean, Pantone, and we had them as a flagship client, telling other clients, potential clients, we were one of the clients, Pantone. My creative team said to me one day, "Larry, if you don't resign this company because we're going nowhere fast, we're going to quit." And I said, "You're going to quit? I'm telling you, Larry, either you say no to them or we say no to you." And I said, "My culture, my people, I mentioned who stayed almost 12 years with me, or 15 years or 20 years." I said, "I'm saying no to them." It was hard, but it was easy because they really were a great brand, but the culture and relationship was awful. It wasn't productive. It was want to bring in your neighbor next door who mows lawns. Let's get his input for marketing and brand. It was like a family affair, and it just didn't make sense at all. So we let them go. But they are the number one brand in the world and today still of PMS colors, of selecting colorful logos or anything. They're number one. But so that was hard. But it was all about the culture fit got worse and worse, and I was forced to either say, "I'll keep the client and my crazy belief," but keeping the client. It just would have gotten worse. What they hired us for, Rick, the value to deliver, they didn't allow us to deliver our value. They were telling us, like, "Yeah, we were order takers. Here's what we want. Here's the copy change. We got a better picture than that picture." And I'm saying, "Why are you hiring us? You're paying us good money, but you're not benefiting from what we do for a living." So we decided we had
Right.
to quit. That was the only client I said no to. Or not no to. I resigned.
I mean, let me just share a perspective on going the other way that I've had many times over my career of having hired and worked with many professionals and service providers. Because what you're saying is that you had to, I'm using the term fire your client because it was a mismatch between the culture of your organization and what you could provide and what they were really, what they in the end wanted from you. And it sounded like you made exactly the right decision for your team. What I was going to share is a little bit different experience that I've had as somebody who's a buyer of professional services. And that is that often what I've found is that the people who are coming to me and saying, okay, we are going to be your designer or architect or whatever it is, what they're doing, and I think this is completely wrong, what they're doing is trying to understand sort of what I want as the customer when what I'm saying to them is what you said, and that is I'm hiring you to give me your best advice about what I should be doing, whether it's legally design, branding, the construction of a project or building, whatever it is. I want to hear what you in your professional capacity believe that my company should be doing, or I as an individual should be doing. And it's really hard to get past that barrier that they're saying, well, we'll just do whatever this client, this guy, or this company says, and that'll be the end of it. And I'm saying, I don't want to work with people who just want to do what I'm telling them to do. I want to work with people who are giving me their best professional advice. Now, I may say, now that I've considered everything else and I'm going to want to go in this direction, that's fine. But I don't want them to just be mouthing back what they think I want to hear.
Right.
Anyway, I'm yakking on here rather than listening to
Oh,
you.
no,
Our
but we
listeners
sure
want to.
otherwise, you know why? Otherwise, like even like Pantone, all we were was an order taker. You pay me money, but I'm providing no value. It's like you're telling me what to do. You don't even need me, or anybody really,
Exactly. And again, to bring it back to decision making, and we'll wrap up here, bring it back to decision making. You will always make better decisions if you're open to hearing what other people are saying, what their opinions are. And I guess what I'm saying is people often, very often, assume you don't want to hear what their real opinion is. And you have, as the leader, you have to sometimes work really hard to give others permission to be open and honest with you and say, it's okay if what you believe I should be doing is different than my preconceptions. Most people don't believe that. And I've been a very successful in a lot of the things I've undertaken in my career. And as somebody who aspires for high achievement with the teams I work with, that is building trust and also giving permission for people to speak up and say what they're really thinking is an important part of the process for creating great leadership and great projects. So, Larry, we kind of run out of time here.
Rick, run out of time. Rick,
I
we can
know,
talk
I know.
for
You
3 hours.
and I, you always
Rick, we're just
want,
starting. We're just getting going,
I know,
Rick.
we are just
Your
starting.
audience right now is saying, "Oh, come on, guys, don't wrap it up now. How about just 10 more minutes?" Oh, come on,
I know,
Rick, you want to really shortchange your audience?
I know, but we're going to get cut off by some element of all of this. So
Okay.
anyway, so Larry, I want to thank you for being a guest, for sharing your experiences. You've made an incredibly valuable contribution to our understanding of how to deal with complex challenges like this. So if
Can
people in the audience were
I just, Rick, I'm sorry. Can I just end with one sentence, one philosophy?
absolutely, go ahead.
Okay. A successful, to everybody's listening, because you start off early about branding. A successful brand is not the result of building a great marketing campaign. It's about building a great business story. What's your business story? How do you make it compelling? How do you make it stick? And how do you communicate that? Communication is another podcast we can have. How to communicate your business story so people know you're purpose driven, you lead by the heart, and you're a great brand that I can identify with, and therefore I want your brand, and the price you're paying for your brand is irrelevant to me because your brand, your values, your brand promise, your deliverables, they align with me, and that's a marriage. And so again, I leave today saying, what brand story can your audience create that'll stick, that'll make sense. I'll go back earlier. So you're perceived as a brand, unlike any other brand in the space you live in. And when you do that, good things happen.
Excellent. Thank you, Larry.
Thank
So
you.
if people want to get hold of you and learn more about you, how do they do that?
My cell phone, which really 7 days a week, 781-710-2121. And my email is my name is Larry at LarryGulko.com, and that's GULKO.
All right, great. You have a lot of nerve giving out your cell phone, but
It's
okay.
okay.
All
It's
right.
okay. I love it.
I want to thank our audience for taking the time to engage with our guest
Thanks,
and
man.
learning from our guest. I hope you found our discussion compelling, valuable, and also engaging. I have two requests. The first request is that you follow this podcast on your favorite podcast channel. By following a podcast, you'll hear when the next podcast episode is out. Second, if you have a compelling story to tell about tough decisions you had to make, come on the podcast as a guest. Go to rickwilliamsleadership.com and then go to the podcast page on the website. Again, that's rickwilliamsleadership.com. Be well.